had a dream about this place.
On the 29th of May 1985, British soccer hooliganism reached its all-time low. Liverpool supporters began a running battle against Italian followers of Juventus at the European Cup final in the Heysel Stadium in Brussels. The result was horrific. The press of bodies trying to escape from the violence led to the collapse of a safety fence. Many victims were trampled to death. Many more were crushed by the weight of their fellow supporters as they struggled in near panic to find a way out. There was great confusion as riot police tried to force their way into the ground to separate the fighting fans. They came up against those in the crowd who had nothing to do with the rioting. They just wanted to get out. Police and ambulancemen struggled to revive some of the victims as the chaos continued round the ground. In the stadium itself, the fighting went on with flagpoles and metal bars used as weapons. Bottles, cans, pieces of concrete were hurled through the air. 41 Italian and Belgian spectators died. 350 were seriously injured. For many Europeans already shocked by the behaviour of British soccer fans abroad, this was the last straw. English football clubs were banned from playing in Europe indefinitely. Dozens of Liverpool supporters were arrested and subsequently brought back to Belgium to face trial. But at the time, as the rescue attempts continued, the principal reaction was bewilderment and disbelief.
It's a war scene. It's nothing other to explain. It's a war picture.
Not football, just football.
No, surely not.
The Prime Minister summed up feelings in general when she said those responsible had brought shame and dishonour to their communities and to British football. It must never happen again, she said.
How Heysel came to be chosen as the location for that European Cup final is still somewhat murky. Every team that had played there in the years leading up to it described the stadium variously as a dump or a shithole. And it was in such a dire state of disrepair that fans were able to simply kick holes in the walls to gain access to the stands and avoid the ticket turnstiles on the night. Now, during the inquiry into the disaster, it turned out that UEFA's inspection team had spent just 25 minutes checking out the ground before declaring it fit to host the game. That Pathé newsreel that you just heard doesn't quite do justice to the full scale of what happened. It wasn't a safety fence that collapsed. That doesn't really describe what happened. It was a concrete wall, and it came down on top of many of the Juventus fans who died. In the aftermath, various English football clubs were banned from all European competitions for a few years. Although the Belgian government had declared a state of siege in Brussels, Wilfried Martens, the Prime Minister at the time, together with the gendarmerie and the Belgian, English and Italian football associations, they ordered the match to go ahead as planned. Their thinking was that cancelling the game could provoke an even bigger riot. And, you know, there may be some logic in that. The teams were thus forced onto the pitch, and they played the full match knowing that 39 people had died. Juventus won 1-0, if you're interested. Now, as is typical for the Belgian justice system. The subsequent inquiry and trial process ground on for years afterwards, and in the final report that was issued by a Belgian judge called Marina Kopitas, responsibility for the disaster was placed squarely on the Liverpool fans. Now, they were undoubtedly at fault. But in a place like Belgium, it's hard to take official accounts of anything particularly seriously. And sure enough, and the reason why we're discussing Heysel, it eventually emerged that the gendarmerie and the Brussels police's handling of the entire affair, before the violence even began, had been an absolute shit show. So true to form, each had devised their own crowd control plans in complete isolation from the other in the months leading up to the match. And while these were the peak years of football hooliganism, and English fans in particular were known to be absolutely horrifying cunts on European nights, all the usual protocols that have been recommended by other police forces on the continent to try and minimize crowd violence, they'd been completely ignored by the gendarmerie. They'd glibly assumed that a few riot units and some dogs would be enough to dissuade troublemakers. So when the violence began, the gendarmerie and the Brussels police refused to coordinate their response or even use their radios to keep one another updated and in the loop about what was happening. This goes back to that agency rivalry that we discussed last episode. And their superiors, in turn, inexplicably failed to pass vital information up the chain of command to headquarters once people began to die. It was also discovered that many of the gendarmes who were on duty that night, they'd not even bothered putting batteries in their walkie-talkies. And inevitably, as UPI reported in 1989, Gendarmerie Captain Johan Mayhew, who was responsible for the organization of the police force at the stadium and accused of having failed to take necessary precautions, received a 9-month suspended sentence. Gendarmerie Major Michael Kensier, who had overall responsibility for the maintenance of order from the gendarmerie headquarters, was acquitted. And for an idea of just how long this inquiry process took, these verdicts were delivered 2 weeks after the Hillsborough football stadium disaster, which happened 4 years after Heysel. So 1985 was proving to be a hellacious year for the gendarmerie. Heysel was one of many fuck-ups they managed to escape all accountability for, but it was also particularly embarrassing for the Belgian authorities because it risked exposing to the rest of Europe what a complete basket case much of the institutional apparatus had become. And it came at a time when the force was already under massive pressure domestically. The Brabant killers had vanished, but there was a wave of armed robberies by other stick-up crews that was fueling this sense that the gendarmerie had no idea what it was doing. Now, we'll get to that in a second, but something else that was going on at this point in time, and something that's worth discussing in more depth, is the CCC, or the Communist Combatant Cells. So the last attack of the Brabant killers' first wave was December 1st, 1983. And remember, at the time, nobody was thinking of this in terms of first wave and second wave. People assumed that they were done. They disappeared and gotten away with it clean, and they were never going to hear from them again. Certainly, that's what they hoped anyway. So in October of 1984, a bomb exploded outside the Lytton Industries building in Ever. And this was a place that was used to manufacture guidance systems for NATO missiles. And the CCC sent manifestos to the major papers and took responsibility for the attack. And then, for the remainder of 1984, all through 1985, the CCC bombed 26 different targets associated in some way with NATO, the US military industrial complex, Belgian state security, or Western anti-communism more broadly, anyone they considered to be an enemy of communism. They hit banks, including a Bank of America building, military communication pylons, NATO pipelines, a Flemish Christian Democrat Party campaign office, Belgian arms companies, a Belgian police station, a liberal think tank office, and so on. Now, one of the CCC's founders, Bertram Sassoy, he had been a communist organizer until he was called up for national service in the Belgian military in the early 80s. And he was stationed at the armory in Vielsalm that we discussed last episode. That was the one that was raided the same night that there was a NATO training operation taking place in the area. Had the hallmarks of a Brabant killer's attack, but there was also rumors of NATO involvement in what happened. Now, Sassoy went AWOL from the army in 1982, and he met Pierre Carette. And they launched a magazine called Subversion, and then they founded the CCC shortly afterwards. The CCC had been created ostensibly as a Belgian counterpart to a French leftist paramilitary group called Action Direct. The cops raided a building in Brussels that they knew was being used as a CCC safe house. And they claimed that they found a couple of guns from the Vielsem Armory raid and the fingerprints of three Action Direct members on them. So by extension, the cops were implying some kind of CCC link to the Vielsem raid. And in response to the CCC's bombing campaign, the justice minister at the time, Jean Gaul, he signed off on Operation Mammoth, and its officially stated aim was to capture the CCC. Now, this did wonders for the government in the polls, you know, was a big boost to public relations, but even politicians and commentators who were otherwise completely unsympathetic to communism or socialism, they felt obliged to point out that in practice, Operation Mammoth didn't really seem all that concerned with capturing the CCC. It seemed like the entire thing amounted to little more than an anti-left counterintelligence operation. Filing cabinets of information were compiled on otherwise peaceful and innocent trade unionists, leftist politicians, academics, and activists. There were even some Belgian Green MPs that were rounded up during this period. And the CCC continued its bombing campaign completely unimpeded. Now, not for nothing, but Operation Mammoth also pulled investigators off other cases that they were working. You know, don't forget. Although we've been painting a picture of like the gendarmerie and the local judicial police forces as being quite crooked, there were still some honest pockets within there, you know. And these guys had been continuing to chase leads from the Pignon affair and the Eurosystem Hospitalier scandal. And there were also others who were pursuing links between the Brabant killers and state security elements. And a lot of them were yanked and put on Operation Mammoth instead. And it was also pointed out that the Brabant killers attracted nothing on the scale of Operation Mammoth, even though the CCC hadn't actually killed anyone yet. They would eventually. They would leave a bomb behind and phone it in. And two firefighters, I believe, would be killed when they went to defuse it. But yeah, this whole thing, Operation Mammoth, even before the CCC had killed anyone, it dwarfed the operations that the government had signed off on against, you know, far-right outfits like Westland New Post or the Youth Front. In January, the CCC bombed a NATO shape office, and then they went quiet. In March of 1985, NATO installed 16 cruise missiles in Belgium with the full support of the government. And this triggered a broadly popular protest movement against this project. You know, it attracted crowds of up to 150,000 people on the streets of Brussels at a time, you know, during the demonstrations. And as this movement continued to grow, a radical group that nobody had ever really heard of before called the FRAP, FRAP, they bombed a NATO building. This was in April. And then in May, the CCC, which again had been in hibernation, suddenly reappeared to bomb the Belgian Business Federation head office. In response, Jean Gaul signed off on a further expansion of Operation Mammoth, gave the gendarmes and the cops and Belgian intelligence services more freedom to crack down on what were called subversive elements. And sure enough, the anti-NATO protest movement was swept off the streets. Naturally, people started to question the timing of the CCC's reappearance and the group's utility as boogeymen for the Belgian establishment to scare the population with. The press supported the government crackdown on this peace movement, and it did its best to justify the repressive tactics used by the gendarmerie with scare stories about left-wing radicals. And years later, Senator Roger Lallemand, as head of the Belgian Gladio inquiry, he would describe this as, quote, a type of media terrorism with journalists and politicians working together to destabilize democratic society and boost support for an authoritarian shift to the right. So we have the gendarmerie, which is mired in corruption and riven by infighting, outmatched by the circumstances. It finds itself in humiliated and increasingly discredited, not just in Belgium now, but after Heysel on the European stage. And one scandal seems to be following another. And now it's being deployed again as a political police force to repress the left while failing to make any real headway in solving the Brabant killer's case. Now, during this interim period between the two waves of the Brabant crew's operations, the gendarmerie and the local police forces were unable and they were unwilling to get on the same page when it came to devising a coherent, unified investigative strategy. And that's without even factoring in the political considerations that were at play. And again, have to emphasize that as 1985 began, it really was accepted wisdom that the crew was gone for good. And like the press and the public, you know, there were different cops adopting different positions on what had really been motivating the gang. And they pursued these pet theories without much oversight. You know, everyone's running off, running their own private investigations. So you had the cops who were otherwise trying to do a decent job of work, who cleaved to the notion that this was at most, you know, a robbery spree with some random attacks tossed in to throw investigators off the trail. You had others who were compelled by talk of strategies of tension and destabilization campaigns and the stay-behind networks and connections to NATO and the Belgian political mafia and intelligence service, who soon found themselves running head-on into the swamp of Belgium's deep politics. And this had, you know, dire consequences for their careers and sometimes even their physical well-being. We discussed this last episode. Then you had other cops and gendarmes who were more than likely aware of who exactly was involved in the attacks and were doing their best to sabotage the investigations. And then there were the guys working the case who were determined to connect the Brabant crew to one or all of the other heist crews operating in Belgium at the time so that they could close a bunch of open cases in one clean sweep. So here's a rundown of the major crews that were active at the time. First, you had the Borain gang. This was led by Michael Cocu. He was yet another ex-cop with a long list of brutality and corruption complaints against him prior to quitting the force. The Borains were an early favourite of the police as being behind the Brabant killer hits, but then they were almost all locked up in 1983. And the jewellery store heist, which happened in that same year, took place after this, so that scratched them as suspects for most police. For a while, though, the cops did speculate that maybe the Borain crew had members who'd escaped the crackdown and were committing Brabant killer-type robberies to try and exonerate the gang members who were still in jail, which was either proof that the cops had completely run out of ideas, or it's a so incredible, it's genius theory, you know. It is worth considering, if only because it makes as much sense as anything else about this story when you view it from the right angle. You had Marshal Lecu, who we mentioned last episode. He was a corrupt gendarme again, and Westland New Post member. He was close to Danny Bahouche. He became a major suspect for professional and amateur Brabant gang investigators. He maintained like a small crew of freelance stick-up artists and drug dealers, which he officially described as informants who were helping him crack major cases. But in reality, they worked for him on a kind of contract basis, carrying out robberies and selling coke and smack that he was pilfering from the evidence lockers. He was also in deep with the political network that surrounded Paul van den Bouillonnance and Baron de Bonvoisin, and he would later tell a Belgian journalist that he and this circle were close to it, and by it, he meant the Brabant killer's crime wave. He would eventually take his family and disappear to America in 1984 after he became a liability for his protectors at the top of the gendarmerie and in parliament. And coincidentally or not, just like Jean-François Bouslik, he wound up in Florida. And we haven't forgot about Bouslik either. Don't worry, that is coming. There was Philippe Disturc's crew, who you'll also see Philippe called Johnny from time to time. It's like a nickname. And Disturc had major heat with Eric Hamers, who was the brother of armed robber Patrick Hamers. Patrick was addicted to coke, and Eric was convinced that Disturc was selling him blow at a discount to keep him neutralized as a potential rival. And Disturc was sent down for armed robbery in 1982, and he escaped from Tonnet prison with 38 other inmates in 1983 during a prison guard strike. Disturc formed a very close business relationship with Jean Bouteau, who was that crooked, jam-loving prison warden we discussed in the Pignon Affair episode. And Bouteau used Disturc's crew to carry out robberies on his behalf, and both he and Disturc were friendly with Francis Desson, who was the leader of the youth run. Bouteau, don't forget, was also the one who called Belgian investigators from his hiding place abroad in later years and said, if you want to solve the Brabant killers' crime wave, you have to look at the Pignon Affair. And of course, Bouteau himself would also become a person of interest in the Brabant killers' case. The Disturc crew's penchant for working on contract for clients like Bouteau and the warden's own suspected links to the Pink Ballets and proven involvement in massive institutional corruption, at the very least. This is why some people believe the Brabant killers' crime wave was actually in part an assassination program that was folded into a broader destabilization operation. You know, let's settle a few scores while we're doing a strategy of tension. And this has also led to speculation that the Brabant crew was actually drawn from a bigger pool of underworld and state operatives who were kind of rotated in and out depending on the requirements of a given mission. This is something that Nick and I have become increasingly sympathetic towards as we've researched this over the last year or so. Now, we've gone way deep on Westland New Post. We don't need to do that again. But they are also in the mix here as major suspects, especially among members of the Belgian left. Gendarmes who pursued this angle, they ran into similar political problems to the ones who were chasing the strategy of tension theory, since, you know, the far right in Belgium and the strategy of tension and the links that kind of spiderweb out from there are so deeply entwined. So the Patrick Hamers gang was also high on the list for a time, but his boys usually targeted much higher value paydays, and Hamers himself, he seemed too flashy and high profile to be involved in something as, you know, pointlessly violent or seemingly pointlessly violent as torture and murder of like cab drivers and restaurateurs, you know, for very little reward. Now, at one time, Hamers was probably the most famous criminal in Belgium. And he and his crew, they prided themselves on their professionalism, you know, coke habits notwithstanding. Most of their jobs, they had them down to a fine art, and they carried them out in 50 seconds or less, and minimal violence was used to achieve their objectives. Hamers was a piece of shit. You know, he was a rapist, don't forget, but he also tried to cultivate this, like, John Dillinger gentleman bank robber sort of Robin Hood vibe, I guess. Now, we'll be getting into Hamers later in the series again because he eventually remembered that he was a Belgian criminal. So that meant that he dropped the classy pro shtick and he just kidnapped Paul van den Buynans in very bizarre and still very controversial circumstances. And still floating around out there was our boy Danny Behouche and his private detective agency slash organized crime operation. Now, in July of 85, two men in gendarme uniforms visited the Wallaby Amusement Park, and they spent some time with management asking about security measures and payroll protocols. And then in August, and this is on a day when there's around 15,000 people visiting the park in total, three men driving a Honda park up in the staff car park, and they sit on a grass verge nearby, and they eat a picnic, and they smoke cigarettes. And at 2:15 p.m., an Interguard driver called Willy Pan pulls into the car park to collect money from the amusement park safe and deliver it to the bank. It's his third collection of the day. He leaves the office with about £37,000 in a secure case. And as he reaches his van, one of the men who'd been picnicking shoots him in the chest. And then he puts four more bullets into Willie's head while he's on the ground. And the three men grab the case and leave. Now, while this isn't considered a canonical Brabant killer's crime, it does have the hallmark of a Bahouche crew job at the very least, and there are suspicions the robbery was carried out to finance the second wave of Brabant killer attacks. And the guys wearing fake gendarme uniforms were never traced, and Bahouche was never charged with it. So, you know, we don't know for sure. The pistol used to kill Pan was a HKP7, which was a weapon bought with a fake name supplied by a gun dealer in Luxembourg who had links to Group Dion, remember, the gendarme security unit. The name was Roger Van Ville, and this was a fake name that Danny Bahouche often used to rent apartments and cars and so forth. The original ID card was stolen by Bayer, and Bahouche's handwriting was also identified as being on the papers. The cops then found a Renault in the amusement park's front car park that had the same radio antenna as the one attached to the car the Bahouche gang used to rob the security guard at the airport in 1982. The amusement park was in Wavre, which is where the Decay's gun shop was attacked in the first wave, and it matches the territory that the Brabant killers were familiar with. Now, according to a girlfriend, Philippe Disterc had admitted to being part of this attack, and he then retracted his confession. But yeah, the cops never closed this case, and multiple investigators would go on to call it a lost Brabant killers attack. The problem with the more street-level crews that the cops and the press had focused on as potential suspects is, it's hard to describe exactly, but in essence, they didn't have that otherworldly vibe of the Brabant killers, that almost supernatural ability to cause absolute carnage for no apparent reason and escape clean. Now, as we discussed towards the end of the last episode, one major theory in the police investigation and amongst the media and the public is that the Brabant killers were committing deliberately noisy robberies to draw the attention of the authorities. So think about it. Their use of violence is usually way out of proportion to the money or the goods that they're stealing or the number of police that they're confronted with. You know, there were also suggestions that they were deliberately sloppy with their disguises during some robberies. You know, sometimes they'd wear carnival masks and balaclavas. Sometimes they'd wear obviously fake wigs and badly applied makeup. And they insisted on bringing the giant with them despite his huge size and the noticeable limp that he walked with. Sometimes, like, they wouldn't even try to conceal their faces, as seen when they carjacked that Austin Allegro back in 1982. Sometimes they'd adopt obviously phony accents when giving orders to victims. It was as if they were trying to fuck with people, you know? Like, it was some kind of elaborate performance art fused with ultra-violence. And they certainly seemed to be intimately familiar with police investigative techniques, and it seemed like they were deliberately planting forensic evidence, you know, shell casings, hairs, pieces of clothing like gloves and hats, you know, fibers, at different crime scenes to ensure that the police would know everything was the work of the same crew. And the question, as ever with these guys, is why? Now, as various investigations into different aspects of the first wave ground on, evidence was lost in the chaos, or it was misplaced, or it was tampered with, or it was hidden from other police teams. Information wasn't shared, leads weren't followed up, or else they petered out completely. Sometimes information wasn't shared for nefarious reasons, you know. Sometimes it wasn't shared because the gendarmes and the cops very often felt like they couldn't trust the people that they were working with. And the political ramifications of investigating some of these more abstract connections in the case, you know, the connections to NATO and the far right and the security apparatus, this also had the police and the gendarmerie spooked. And overall, the majority of investigators were desperate for this thing to either go away, you know, the pressure to ease off and just quietly become and unsolved, or else close it out quickly with minimal damage to the reputation of the Belgian establishment. And this pressure, it inevitably trickled down the chain of command. And in a force already struggling with corruption and dysfunction, this was death for morale. I mean, we are talking about a federal police force here, the gendarmerie, that gave so few fucks about its responsibilities. It didn't even bother to put batteries in its communication equipment the night of the Heysel disaster, you know. And as mentioned, there's also the fact that numerous armed gangs were active around this time, and similarities were bound to crop up between different crimes that had nothing to do with each other. But it had lots of cops and amateur sleuths and reporters joining the wrong dots and making the wrong connections, sometimes out of honest error, sometimes for more sinister reasons. Now, the CCC leadership was eventually caught at the end of 1985, but the suspicion persisted that the CCC and the Brabant crew and FRAP and Westland New Post and all these other paramilitary groups were actually reporting to the same masters in the Belgian security service, because it hadn't gone unnoticed that the ruling Christian People's Party had seen positive movement in its public approval rating due to the way it handled the far left threat, you know. And don't forget either that the Belgian far right was still very active, although, as we've mentioned, the Westland New Post had apparently dissolved. There'd been a number of arrests and splinter factions breaking away throughout 1983. And the founder, Paul Latinus, he'd of course committed suicide in mysterious circumstances, saying suicide very much in air quotes there. So yeah, Belgium is a normally peaceful country, despite the things that we've covered in this series so far. But the late 70s to the mid 80s, they were proven to be a profoundly chaotic time. You know, there's economic malaise that was inflaming those regional divides. There was a wave of political unrest, crime, and radical violence as well, you know. And there were also all these various corruption scandals that were undermining trust in the state's institutions. All of this taking place in an atmosphere that was soaked in the dread of the Cold War. So yeah, Belgium, 85, was a powder keg. And on the 22nd of September, the authorities' complacent assumption that the Brabant killers had disappeared turned out to be completely wrong. Around 4 in the morning, a team of thieves break into the lot of a VW dealership in Urquhart, and they steal a grey Golf GTI in the 5-minute window between security patrols. And then 5 days later, on the 27th, in Braine, a black Opel parks next to a pizzeria that sits adjacent to a Delhaize supermarket. And the driver is described as a very large man with bushy grey sideburns. And this guy lingers for a while, and then he leaves, and then shortly afterwards, the Golf that was stolen on the 22nd pulls into the same parking spot. Three men climb out, wearing military overcoats and carnival masks, and they cross from the pizzeria into the Delhaize supermarket car park. Now, the tallest crew member, the giant, he's carrying a submachine gun. The killer and the old man are packing pump-action shotguns. There's a 12-year-old kid in the supermarket car park. He's racing around on his BMX. And the giant grabs him by the hair and takes him hostage. A guy waiting in his van with his son for his wife and daughter to finish up inside the store spots the crew approaching and barely has time to warn his kid to duck before the crew spray the van with bullets, killing the man and injuring his son. Another man exiting the supermarket tries to confront the crew, and the killer just guns him down. People inside the store obviously begin screaming. There's mass panic. They try to escape out the back. The crew step into the supermarket and they rake the interior with machine gun fire. They kill another customer in the process. And then the giant moves along the checkout lanes, ordering the cashiers to empty their tills, still holding his hostage. The killer and the old man head straight to the manager's office, where they destroy the telephone lines and alarm system before ordering the manager to open the vault. The problem is, the manager doesn't know the combination. So instead, he opens a smaller vault containing far less money, and the killer and the old man fill a pair of bin bags with the cash they find. They return to the giant, and then the three leave the supermarket while firing at anybody in peeking out from behind their hiding places. The giant lets go of the kid, who is terrified but unharmed. In all, they stole just over 20 grand from this hit, and witnesses describe how they seemed in no real hurry to leave. They calmly return to their getaway car, they jump in, and they pull out, and then the hatchback pops open, and one of them sits braced against the back seat, pointing his gun at any cars that are following them. They drive just under 20 miles to Overijse, and they hit another Delhaize supermarket 15 minutes later. Now, on the way into this one, a 14-year-old boy spots the crew and tries to call for help, and he's immediately hit with a shotgun blast that kills him instantly. There are also four local activists, and they are putting up campaign posters for the impending local elections. The crew scare three of them off with gunfire. They grab the fourth to use as a hostage. There's a guy on his way to buy a newspaper, Leon Finet. You remember this name because we are going to circle back to him later. He tries to make it back to his car, but the crew riddle him with bullets, then take the time to walk up to his body and finish him off with another shot to the head, a coup de grace. While one of them acts as a lookout, the other two head into the supermarket and they follow the same procedure as before, spraying bullets everywhere and screaming threats while 200 customers try to escape out the back. They empty the cash registers and they kill a cashier who can't open her till. And again, they hit the supermarket safe, and on their way out, they destroy the telephone lines and security alarms. They cover their exit by spraying the store with more indiscriminate gunfire. And this time, instead of letting their hostage go, they take him out with the shotguns. Then they climb into their getaway car. They fire a few wild shots at a guy who's trying to take down their license plate number. And then they escape. The level of violence, ultra-violence, in this new round of attacks is way beyond anything the crew had deployed previously. And the public outrage at how they were able to shoot up two different supermarkets, 20 miles apart, killing children and adults alike in the same night, leaves the police looking useless at best and outright complicit at worst. And it doesn't help that the hits were committed across the regional borders of Belgium, you know, different jurisdictions as well as different languages. The two Delhaize supermarkets were more than likely chosen for that reason. The government finally creates a special task force to deal with the Brabant crew, and they work up a list of about 50 likely robbery targets. They arm patrol officers with military-grade shotguns and machine guns. They position snipers on nearby rooftops. The numbers vary from place to place, and more cynical observers say this extra security is purely for show, really. The investigating teams now have been forced to hold weekly meetings where they pool information with colleagues and coordinate their strategy. And the gendarmes and the local police generally agree that the violence this time seems almost theatrical. It's as if the Brabant killers are playing up to their image in the press to establish that they really have returned. This is really them. November 9th, around 7:30 at night, a gendarme team that's assigned to guard the Delhaize supermarket in the town of Aalst ends its surveillance shift 30 minutes before the night detail is supposed to take over. They haven't been gone more than 5 minutes when the Brabant crew's Golf GTI rolls down an alleyway that opens onto the supermarket car park. They park up at the far end. They step out of the vehicle carrying tactical assault shotguns, a submachine gun, and wearing trench coats and Kevlar vests. There's the giant, who, from what I've gathered, seems to be disguised with an Afro wig and blackface. This is Belgium. His two buddies, they're wearing balaclavas. And the car park has a few early evening shoppers milling around, you know, including the Van der Steen family. There's parents, Gilbert and Mary Therese, and their children, Rebecca and David. They spot the Brabant crew approaching, and witnesses later describe the family as freezing for a moment, with Rebecca imploring the killers not to shoot. The giant guns her and Gilbert down anyway, kills them instantly. Then they blow away Mary Therese, and as the crew begin indiscriminately firing at people in the car park and the front of the supermarket, the little kid, David, he sprints inside. Another guy is killed outright just inside the entrance. The giant and the old man enter the store and they set to work emptying cash registers and shooting at anybody in sight. And the killer patrols the front entrance. He's blasting at anything that moves. Eyewitnesses describe the crew as alternating between roaring and gibbering, as in roaring like, you know, tigers or lions, not just yelling, and laughing and joking as they carry out the attack. The killer even finds time to just shoot at signs that are squeaking in the breeze, you know, road signs. Gendarmes in a passing patrol car, they've alerted the local police to the gunshots, but then they reverse up the street until the backup arrives. And this is delayed by, or so it's later said, a number of the responding officers being unable to start their engines. Now, unclear how many of these cars had engine trouble or why, but when they finally arrive, they set up at the far end of the car park. Now, it's unclear whether the cops were hanging back to see how things played out, or if they had some tactical ideas in mind and this was a really half-assed kind of roadblock, or whether they sincerely thought they'd make the situation worse, you know, or if they were simply refusing to engage the crew. But either way, the Brabant killers, by this point, calmly walking back to their getaway car with two bags of stolen cash and a small change tin, they spot the police and a full-on gunfight erupts. And you can find a few crime scene photographs of this one online. And I'm not kidding you. It looks like something out of a war movie. You know, the front of the supermarket has all the windows blown out. There's blood pooling and splattered all over the place. The inside of the store is completely wrecked. There's spent shell casings everywhere. There's parked cars riddled with bullet holes as well. And as the crew drive away, they again pop open the boot of the car, the trunk, and one of them covers the escape with bursts of gunfire from the back seat. The cops pepper the Golf with bullets. They riddle this fucking thing, but it's too late. It's doing over 100 miles an hour in short order, leaves the gendarmes and the police far behind. There is a police van that keeps pace for a time before losing them, and naturally, a few of the cops later swear in their reports that somebody had to have been hit. They were firing on the Golf from all directions. And one cop said that the crew member dubbed the killer did appear to be bleeding profusely, but hospital records don't show any gunshot admissions that are consistent with the firefight, and it's still unknown if any of the crew were really injured or killed. 8 people were killed in this one, and the crew made off with just under £25,000. Now, it's almost impossible to adequately convey the terror, you know, the outraged disbelief this one provoked, because time and again, the police and the government had sworn that this time they were taking the threat seriously, that they had plans to deal with all contingencies, that there was no way the crew would be able to get away with another job. And time and again, this has turned out to be, you know, bullshit. So there are inquiries promised, there are minor tweaks to methodology and investigative procedures that are tabled and then half-heartedly implemented. The idea that the authorities are either complicit with or indifferent to the Brabant killers becomes more persuasive by the day. And the country braces itself and it's wondering where the crew are going to hit next. How many people are going to die when they do reappear? And what excuses will the authorities offer when it happens? So they wait for another attack, and they wait, and they wait. But there won't be another one. November 9th, 1985 is the date of the last official armed robbery ever carried out by the Brabant killers. After that, they vanish into the dark mythology of the European underworld, leaving behind 28 dead bodies and 100 different puzzle fragments that people are still trying to piece together today. The remainder of this episode and all of the next one is going to be concerned with trying to puzzle out what the fuck actually happened in Belgium between 1981 and 1985. And while we are going to try our best to go as big as possible, maximalist, probably goes without saying that plenty of people much closer to the events have spent 40 years thinking about this case, and many of them are still no closer to an explanation now than they were back in the 80s. People have lost their lives following this thing, you know. It's tempting to treat the entire story as some aberration, you know, draw a line under it and move on. But for a lot of researchers, ourselves included, the Brabant killers make the most sense when you view them as part of that much bigger matrix of corruption in Belgium that we've been describing. And one case in particular haunts investigators because it seems to have some very murky but real connections, not just to the Brabant crew, but the horrifying events of the 1990s. So now we're going to have to go back to 1984 and talk about a murder in Oudeham in Brussels. To unlock the rest of this episode, please head over to patreon.com/ghost stories for the end.